Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and is not suitable for children. This episode in particular deals with PTSD in the police force and contains harrowing accounts of the reality of policing. So please proceed with caution.
The psych that I saw, I still see her every now and then, but she described PTSD as like a bottle. And when I started policing, my bottle was pretty much empty. Every job I went to that had an effect on me was represented by a drip of water in that bottle. And what happened with all these jobs that I'd done, it was really just the bottle was slowly filling. And when I did that job with the child porn, that's when my bottle overflowed. Hence, the bottle couldn't take any more water.
When Narelle Fraser joined the police force at the age of 27, she did it because she wanted to help people. That's just who Narelle is. Victims of horrific sexual and violent crime were her specialty, and she prided herself on being strong enough to support others through their trauma without letting it break her. Eventually, though, she found herself in a coffee shop across the road from the Crown Court with no recollection of how she'd gotten there or where she was supposed to be. She knew something had changed, but at that stage, she'd never even heard of post-traumatic stress disorder.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Today, there are hundreds of former Australian police officers living on a disability pension because of PTSD. The suicide rate among current and former Australian police is inordinately high, leading one anonymous whistleblower serving in the Australian Federal Police to tell a journalist his workplace was like looking at a whole lot of ticking time bombs and wondering which one would go off. He contacted the reporter after a female officer took her own life inside the AFP's Melbourne headquarters in February of 2017. He went on to say that she was the third in 12 months. For Narelle Fraser, diagnosis came as a massive shock.
I remember when I went to the psych when I was first diagnosed with PTSD, and she was doing the same thing. Now, Narelle, tell me about all these jobs you've done, and what do you think's got you to this point? And I remember there were so many that I just couldn't work out which ones to tell her, so I went home. And I wrote what I call the list, and there was 33 really big jobs that I felt had affected me and got me to that point. And I've got the list here just to help me try and work through all the incidents that had got me to that point. Maria Corp, that was a huge job in my career because with that job, I actually got into the boot to check for Maria's signs of life. When we found the car, it had been it was in the hot February sun for 4 days.
In February of 2005, Melbourne woman Maria Corp was reported missing. 4 days later, she was found in the boot of her car, which was parked a stone's throw from Melbourne's CBD near the War Memorial. She'd been throttled by her husband's lover and left there to die.
When we got the boot open, we saw her there and we all thought she was dead. She wasn't breathing. And then just to make sure, somebody, I think it was one of the sergeants, said somebody left to get in there and make sure. So I offered. I mean, just to see Maria there so helpless and so hopeless and obviously, well, as we thought, dead or deceased. And so I hopped in the boot and I laid next to her and I was checking for signs of life. And I actually, I couldn't find any signs of life. And then just at whim, I thought, I might just put my head on her chest. So I put my head on her chest and Her chest moved up and down. It was just the most, and I remember yelling to everyone, she's alive, she's alive, because she was decomposing, like she was in a terrible way. And we rushed her to hospital, and she never regained consciousness.
No.
She died 6 months later. That's a big job in anyone's career.
Yeah. Maybe we should start at the end sort of thing, which is that, well,
I don't know where to start.
Well, I'm fascinated by the list, but I mean, now you, I've heard of you as a public speaker who speaks about PTSD.
Yes.
And speaks incredibly effectively about it from your own experience. So what made you go and seek out help at work from the psych? Did you know you had PTSD?
No.
Okay.
In fact... I had no idea what PTSD was.
Mm.
I had been working for 27 years as a cop. The last 15 were in the squads. And I loved my job. I thought I was really emotionally, I thought I was really strong, and I was well respected. But I went, there was two things that happened in quick succession, and I thought, this isn't, there's something wrong. And up until then, I really didn't know what was wrong. But the two things that happened were, it was in May of 2012, and I went to a child porn job. Now, I had done hundreds of child porn jobs and warrants and interviewing child,
offenders.
Call them? Offenders, yeah.
Wow.
So this one was different, though. It when we did the warrant, we found 1,700 child pornographic videos, and don't worry, I won't go into detail about what they were, but just to say that they were horrific. It took me 2 days to view those videos, and you ask, why do you have to, why would you have to do that? But for a magistrate to sentence somebody accordingly, for me just to say there were 1,700 child pornographic videos, it doesn't really give it the seriousness. I mean, it's serious, don't get me wrong, but to grade them. So instead of saying, we grade them from one at the, I don't know if they do this now, but one to five, five being the absolute worst. And so we grade all the videos, and so I can get up to the magistrate and then say, well, actually, 1,400 of them were at the number five. So that gives her some idea, or him, sorry, or her, some gravity as to how bad these. I mean, any child porn is bad, but this was at the worst end. So that's why we do that, to help the magistrate to sentence somebody.
How do you do that? Like, what's the process? Do you don't do that alone, do you?
I was actually with a colleague.
Yeah.
But yes, you do it alone. You sit in a room, you go to the computer crime squad, because they try, obviously, and look after you as much as they can. So you go to a computer crime squad, you sit in a room, it's a very plain room, it's just got a computer, and you play the videos, but there's signs everywhere about, if you're feeling distressed, you know, call somebody or go and have a break. And I remember, I had seen so many, I certainly wasn't blasé, but I didn't think there was much that could shock me.
But so you'd like apply just your professional approach, try and almost detach from
what you're seeing.
Well, you
have to, or you couldn't do your job really. Yeah. So when I watched these 1,700, they were so bad, I'd never had a reaction like this. I can remember, I don't know if this will show up on here, but I remember going, and I put my hand over my mouth. Like, I'd never done that before, and I thought, oh, it was just so distressing to me. I couldn't control my emotions. And I remember I had to go out and go for a walk outstairs, go and have a coffee. And I did 2 days of this, and my colleague, and it was actually on my birthday.
Oh,
yeah, so well, I will never forget it, obviously. So that was one job that really sort of, I think that's when I started to unravel. And about a week later, and I went back to work, and after watching these videos, and I remember something had shifted, something changed, and I didn't know what. The following week, I had a committal for a rape, and the rape victim, she was a young teenager, and she was living, DHS had taken her out of the home. Anyway, the bottom line is that I had to get her to court to give evidence. And she was at home and she was in bed, curled up in the fetal position, and she wasn't going to go. And I understood that, but what a quandary, because if she doesn't give evidence, the guy gets away with it. So I felt so strongly about, I had to really, oh, it was terrible. I remember putting my arm around her and she was screaming, I can't do this, Narelle, I can't go. And like in my heart, I was just breaking because I didn't want her to really, but in another way, I needed her to so that we could get him and put him behind bars. And anyway, I finally get her to court, and she's in the witness box, and I'm behind her as the informant. I have to be there, and there's witnesses outside, and there's quite a lot to do in a committal as an informant. And I remember she was in the witness box, and she was getting hammered by the defence, because there was two offenders, so there was two defence people, and she was getting hammered. And I thought to myself, pardon me, this is bullshit. She is being raped all over again, and I felt so responsible. And the next thing I remember is the court staff coming over to the coffee shop. I was across the road from the court, and I was having a coffee. And they said, Narelle, the magistrate and the defence, the prosecution, everyone's looking for you. What are you doing here? And I remember I was very embarrassed, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? Why am I having a coffee? I remember putting my head in my hands when they left. I said, I'll be over there in a minute. I just had something to do. I was embarrassed. Yeah. I'm thinking, what's going on?
Had that ever happened to you before?
No, never. And I was supposed to be in the court, and I couldn't get my head around. I couldn't remember after the girl being hammered and then being over at the court. I was missing, like, I don't know, 20 minutes, something like that.
Wow.
Anyway, later I found out that it was a form of, well, it was not a form, it was amnesia. So what had happened is that my mind had just shut down and it had stopped. And so I remember that night going home and thinking, wow, what on earth? I couldn't work out what was going on. And so I had a holiday, thinking I needed a bit of a break. So I said to I didn't say what was going on, but I said, look, I think I'm getting I need a bit of a holiday. I just need a couple of days off just to clear my head. No worries. And I went back and I wasn't any better.
Mm.
And that's when I thought, you know what, Narelle, I think you'd better go to a doctor. And I went to the doctor, and I've forgotten the date, but it was in September that I went to the doctor. It was a Monday morning, and I cried, you know, for the first 5 minutes. And he said, I think you've got PTSD. And I said, what's that? And he said, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I said, no, I couldn't, no, you got the wrong person. I mean, I've done this all my life. I love it. And he said, Narelle, that's what I think it is. Let's just send you to a psych. So just to confirm it. Well, the psych took about 30 seconds. And she said, absolutely. And she explained about the amnesia. That's what that was. And everything started to fall into place. But I was so embarrassed. I was humiliated. And it was like, me, PTSD, I'm Narelle Fraser. I mean, I'm strong. That doesn't happen to me. And that's really the start of the end. And from that day, I loved the police force, and I still do. I miss it, but I know it's, you know, I've done my time. But I never, ever went back into my office. I never walked in the door again because I began to realise the damage that had been done, and I never, ever wanted to go back.
I think a lot of people think, oh, PTSD, what's that? Or, you know, is it an excuse? Have you ever encountered that attitude?
I mean, I didn't know what PTSD was either. And what I do now is I want to educate people, and this stigma that is around mental health. I have trouble. The hardest part for me was actually accepting that I had PTSD because I'm just so, quote, normal, unquote. I'm actually on a disability pension from the police. They've been very good to me. And I even have trouble admitting that to myself or to say that. It just sounds so, a disability pension, wow. You know, that's pretty serious stuff.
It is.
Working with victims, I worked, most of my career has been dealing with victims, and I don't have any qualms in saying that is my strength.
Mm-hmm.
More so than knowing the law of, you know, section, well, 21A of the Crimes Act, for instance, stalking. I feel really strongly about that stalking. But that wasn't my, you know, knowing the ins and outs of every law. But my strength was my emotional strength. And, of course, when I was diagnosed, it was like that was me. Mm-hmm. That was my reputation. And
but I feel like every time you gave of yourself to victims in that way, it must have taken from you.
Oh, absolutely. When I look back, yes, like there were so many emotionally difficult jobs, but this sounds bizarre, but when I was working at Bendigo, Bendigo Socket, this was where I actually fell over, I unravelled sort of, that's a sexual offence and child abuse investigative team. That was my forte, was sexual offences and dealing with children and victims of sexual assaults. So when I was there, I don't have kids and all my colleagues did. So what I used to do is how, like this is just, I think, what were you thinking, Narelle? So what I'd do is if there was a really tough emotional job with a child, I would always put my hand up because I'd, and I'm not, I was, wasn't trying to be a martyr or a hero, nothing like that. But I wanted to save my colleagues from, like, they've got to go home to their kids. Like, fancy seeing a deceased little baby or a deceased child and they've got to go home. Like, so I wanted to save them, the trauma.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? In the end, I couldn't even save myself, let alone my colleagues.
But how can anyone work through that and not come out with PTSD? Is that even possible?
Yeah.
Well, funny you say that. I think my own view is most police, you cannot do that sort of stuff. We join because we want to be part of the community. We want to help the community. That's why you join, I think, a lot. And I'm joined also because I wanted to make a difference. But these sort of jobs, I don't know how you can't be affected. So I believe most police have a form of PTSD, but what I feel so passionate about now is to go out and talk to police and tell them there's nothing to be ashamed of in the fact that you're upset by a child being killed in a car accident. Who the hell wouldn't be?
Yeah.
And so I don't know how somebody can say they're not affected. They would.
I find it
odd. It's possible, but I don't know how.
But I find that weird. Do you know what I mean? I find it weird if someone says they haven't been affected by police work. I think
they're kidding themselves, to be honest. But, you know, I am fairly in touch, I suppose, with emotions and that sort of stuff. I always have been interested in, like, even with an offender. Victims, I feel very strongly for them, but also offenders. Like, I think, why have they done what they've done? You know, I'm interested in the psyche behind it.
Yeah.
The psychology, why have they done what they've done? Where have they got to? What's happened in their life that they've got to this point where they've killed someone or they've raped someone? Like, you don't just walk down the street one day and think, oh, I'm going to rape someone or I'm going to murder someone. Like, that's what I find interesting.
Mm.
Well, one of the many things I find interesting about policing.
The thing I find I'm thinking a lot about right now is, you know, we've got work stuff. We all want a safe workplace. But the sheer nature of being a cop, you are almost going into an unsafe workplace because of the nature of your work. So whether it's you're going out into the public, you're sitting in a room watching child porn videos, how can that be anything but, like, how do they protect you? I just don't get how you can do your job and actually not be traumatised.
I don't know how you can, but I think a lot of it is about money and getting more support. Mm. You go into the police force, you know that there's going to be every day, you don't know whether you make thousands of decisions per shift. You only need one of those decisions to turn to shit. You make the wrong decision and you can affect so many people's lives. There's a lot of pressure. So what you need to do is we need to educate out at the academy when people first come in. You don't come in thinking I'm not going to see a dead body. You're always, at some point, you are going to see traumatic things. But it's about educating the emotional side as well. Policing isn't just a physical thing, it's emotional as well.
How did you used to take care of yourself? What kind of things would you do for self-care?
I've always had a really strong support base outside of the police force. I made some beautiful friends that are still friends of mine in the police force. But I also realised that I had to speak to and be around, pardon me, normal people.
Civilians,
know, not
where,
cops.
Yes. You know, my girlfriends are having issues with their husband or their kids or the drop-off at school, something disastrous happened. It was nice to just be around people that had normal problems, not that have been raped or murdered. Or it was just lovely to – I found that as a really important part of – coping. I also don't have a television at home. My husband and I haven't had a TV for 21 years.
Wow.
And that is really important because I found that my husband and I actually talk. We don't talk a great deal about, we talk a lot about the job, like something that happened during the day, but I couldn't actually tell my husband about some of the really bad things because I just think, why would you bring someone into that terrible world? But it was lovely to go home and just, I don't know, not have a TV and not be reminded. Like if I'd done a crime scene during the day and you go home and you watch it of a night, it's like, God, give me a break.
I can understand that.
So it was, I've got a very, very strong support base.
That, you had a life outside of work.
Yes.
That you, it sounds to me that you guarded very carefully.
Yeah. And, but policing can become all-consuming.
I bet.
And
it's switching the mind off to me.
It got to the point I couldn't do it. I couldn't. Yeah. When I was at my worst, I was thinking, walking, talking, working, everything police. I just couldn't get that escape. But that was obviously one of the signs, you know.
So would you mind if we went back to your list of 30?
Yeah, 33.
33. I'm quite fascinated by the list. So
yep.
When you first met the psych and she said, go home and...
No, she didn't. I just couldn't get my head around all these jobs. I'm thinking, God, there's this one. And then I thought, I'm just going to go home and write them down just to help me as well.
33 jobs, even that you call them jobs.
But they're major jobs.
But even that you call them jobs is sort of, to me... No, I love it because it's sort of, you're normalising it and you're underplaying it. Like cases sounds more glamorous. Jobs, we'll call them.
What about investigations?
Investigations.
That sounds very important.
It's very glamorous.
Well, I don't know where to start. I suppose one of the first ones that really affected me, St Kilda, suicide in Laneway. Now, that was, I was doing... my training station was St Kilda.
Wow.
Now, yeah, wow's right.
Tough.
I didn't know anyone in the police force. I didn't know anything about policing when I was 27 is when I joined, and I'd been a secretary for, I don't know, 15 years. I started working as a secretary at 16 years of age. And there's prostitutes, there's drugs. But I always felt the prostitutes, they were treated abysmally by police back then in 1987 when I joined.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, she is actually, and young boys were prostituting themselves again as well, but I used to think they are actually people that have had a bad trot. There but for the grace of God go I think they say. And I thought, you can't treat somebody like a piece of dirt, like they're a person as well. So I used to speak to the prostitutes and like I used to get really good info from them who was dealing that because they trusted me. So going back, so St Kilda was like a wow, it was.
You couldn't have got a tougher start because there was a lot of stuff going on with police back then, wasn't there?
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
I like saying this.
Yeah.
I could tell you off air.
Yeah.
Isn't that what they say?
Yeah. But it also doesn't surprise me that being a person who wants to help other people, I mean, St Kilda particularly in those days, was full of people who needed help. It was full of disenfranchised, sad, lonely people who were just surviving.
And, you know, all they're doing, really, they're just looking for love and support like we all are.
Yeah.
But they just haven't been able to find it. Yeah. I mean, so I used to feel real sorry for them, and I wanted to really put my arm around them, and it sounds sick, doesn't it? But that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to be somebody that could help them out of a...
You might have been the only person who actually showed them any...
Mm. Well, there wasn't many. In fact, a couple of times it was, hey, Fraze, that's what they used to call me, hey, Fraze, come on, cut this emotional crap, you know. She's a crow. That's what they used to call them, crows. She's a crow.
So that's the first job that you remember as being a drop of water in that little bottle of yours was the suicide in St Kilda?
Oh, but a very little drop. I mean, it was just the first time I'd ever seen anybody that had he'd put a gun to his head and he was in a car. And that's the first time I'd ever seen anything so violent.
Yes.
It was really – but I couldn't say – I'm not downplaying it, but that was I knew that that was going to happen a lot, and it did. I saw a lot of those sort of things. But the first one you never, ever forget. Mm. But it was a little drop, I suppose. But the drops to me were the real big jobs that I did. And that's what I mean. It sounds like, oh, that wasn't a big
job. No, it sounds. What were the big drops? Talk to us about
that. The big drop. The first big drop I had was when I was at Carlton. And that was my first station that I'd been gazetted to. And, you know, you felt pretty bloody important. I was a constable now. I wasn't a trainee. Mm. And it was probably only about a month into, probably a bit more, maybe 6 months. But anyway, there's a job to a 7-Eleven in Carlton. And it was from the guy that was behind the counter. And he said, there's a woman here and she's acting very strange. I don't quite know what she's doing. And we said, oh, we'll come around. And it was about, say, 4 o'clock in the morning, something like that. And we go around there and she was definitely affected. She was really strange. And I went up to her and I said, is everything okay? And clearly it wasn't. And I said, would you mind? He thought she might have pinched something. So I said, would you mind if I had a look in your bag? And she said, yeah, sure. So she opened it up and she had 5 aerosol cans in there. And they were clearly used. They hadn't been pinched or anything. Anyway, we just got chatting and she was just at a loss. She'd broken up with her boyfriend. She was a prostitute, absolutely, clearly. Like she had, I suppose after working at St Kilda, she had lots of stuff in her bag. Like she had condoms, she had makeup, perfume, all the stuff that it was a bit of a giveaway. And I said to her, you know, why don't you, where do you live? And she said, I just live just around the corner. I said, look, if you don't mind getting in the back of the div van, I'll take you home. And she said, you'd take me home? I said, well, yeah, you know, and she lived with her folks. So I took her home. Anyway, about an hour later, we got a call to a service station just around the corner from the 7-Eleven, and it was for somebody on fire. Mm. And so we, of course, raced down there, and I've got a trainee with me. I've been in 6 months, like this, I've been in 18 months by this stage, but I'm just at Carlton 6 months. And the guy that I was with, the trainee, quite a responsibility when you think about it. But anyway, so we go to this job with a person on fire, and they were on fire. They were in a gutter and they were writhing around and people were screaming. And I remember thinking, oh my God. God, because they were actually on fire. Mm. And I remember racing up to the person because everyone else is avoiding it like the plague. And my colleague, the trainee, who's a beautiful young man, and he was as white as a ghost. And I thought he was going to faint or be sick. And I said, you stay in the car. Can you get the ambos? Can you get the fireys? And the person was in the gutter and I went and kneeled next to the person, and it was horrific because they were burnt like black. I didn't know who it was or whether it was male or female. And what they'd done is they'd strapped aerosol cans to their body, poured petrol over themselves and set themselves alight. It was a person was a real mess. So I kneeled down next to them and I sort of, I can't believe I did this, but I grabbed the person's hand and I just sort of said, it's okay, I've got the ambos or whatever coming. And the person spoke to me, and I can remember when she spoke, I didn't know who it was, and I can always remember the teeth being so white. And the person said, "Narelle."
Oh my God.
"It's me." And I said, "Who is it?" And she said, "It's Julie." That was the girl's name. And I said, "Julie." And that wasn't, you know, a time to converse.
No, it's not. But you want to say, "What the hell, Julie?"
That was only an hour before that you'd taken her home.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then I feel bad saying this, but it was a different job back then. But it was very traumatic. But I must have just put it all away, and I had a job to do. And I stayed with her, and I remember the fireys coming and just sort of spraying her, and they were all really distraught. And in the end, they took her to a hospital and she died. But I can always remember I rang the sergeant, or he must have rung me, and I said, look, I'm coming back. This was at about 7 o'clock in the morning. I've just finished. I was on night shift, right? So I'm supposed to finish at 7. And he said, "Oh, before you come back, the parents are just around the corner. Can you go and tell the parents?"
Oh, my God.
And I said, "Well, actually, I can't, because I don't know how to say it nicely, but with the spray from the fireys, I had bits of her on me." And I said, "I can't do this." And he said, "I'm telling you, as a sergeant, go round and tell her parents."
No.
So I can remember sitting in the lounge room, giving a death message, which is one of the worst jobs in the police force, and I've got really bits of this girl on, bits of their daughter. Like, how unprofessional is that? But the sergeant said, and I thought, well, the sergeant's saying.
Well, that's what you did back then. What you were told.
And
didn't
I'm not criticising. Yeah. I mean, of course it sounds terrible, but it was just a different job back then. But that is the first.
The big one.
That's a pretty big
one. Because that's certainly not in any way a normal situation to find yourself in.
No. After that, of course, I went home. It was like I got back to the office and everyone's changing shifts and, "G'day, how are you?" And "Oh, here, you've got a job to..." Like, it was all happening, but nobody said, "Oh, how are you?"
There's no debrief. There's no Narelle. Go and see the psych, have a day off. No, there's none of that.
Nobody said anything to me. And I remember thinking, wow, this job is. So I went home, and of course, my mind and I couldn't get in the shower quick enough because my clothes stank.
Yes.
And I took them to the dry cleaners. I couldn't sleep that day. In fact, I had trouble sleeping for probably about a week. And as bizarre, as awful as this sounds, I had trouble going to barbecues because the smell was, it was just, it. And then I thought, you better toughen up. So, but that was the first real terrible job. Gee, you're obviously making me feel very relaxed, because normally I wouldn't say that, because it's a bit, I'm just looking at the two of you thinking, oh, maybe I shouldn't be saying
this. I'm intrigued, because I think this is going to help people a lot. Just
you
hearing
think,
this.
Like, I'm just thinking now.
I do.
Oh, this is the reality of policing, and people no one talks this. About it. Yep. And and this is, again, the purpose of this podcast, as we say in the beginning, is to go beyond the news cycle. So you read this salacious headline about a person being burnt and you go, oh, God, that's terrible. And a day later you've forgotten about it and you never think about it again. But there are the ripple effects of something like that. Are enormous, and you are one of them. You are one of the people impacted by that story that we forget so quickly.
Another thing is that by me telling you, see, this is my issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
By me telling you, then I think, well, what about Michelle going home? What about you going home? What about Kieran? Like, you get to the point where you think, I really shouldn't be telling anyone this because it affects everybody. But in the end, I suppose, as you say, if people don't know what police really do, they're going to think, you know, oh, those bloody coppers, you know, what are they doing having a coffee?
I don't think you should have to carry it for the rest of us. I don't think you should have to keep it inside yourself to spare us. I don't think you should have to do that.
And well, I suppose I'm so used to it.
But, you know, we have asked you here, and not only that, the podcast has a warning at the start, so there's nobody involved in this process who isn't completely aware and you know, ready for what you have to tell us.
Yeah.
And I think all of us in this community of ours, of this podcast, just feel like this is real life and we should know about it.
And it is real life, and I think that's another reason why I'm so glad I don't have a TV, because when I go and watch TV, say at my sister's, it is so graphic now. And I think, you know, what your people watch NCIS and all these bodies being cut. And I think that was my reality. I can't watch them because it brings back so many terrible jobs that I did. I think, no, I'll watch my beloved Tigers, I'll watch the football, because there is nothing about the football other than pure joy or absolute tearing your hair out. But that's why my sister will often say, oh, look away, Narelle, or, but it's hard. You know, even ads, like with dogs, for instance, like everybody's got a dog. I would never go into this one, but I have terrible triggers and terrible flashbacks about dogs to do with child pornography. So I can't, like, just a simple thing like a dog, you know, like
you can't own one. You can't, like, if I showed you photos of my dogs, it would trigger you, like
it wouldn't. Well, yes, it would to a point, but everyone's got dogs.
Yeah.
Like my sister, you know, they love their dog. Both of my sisters have dogs. I mean, they're cute little dogs, but there's just something a little bit makes me feel just a little bit uncomfortable because of what I've witnessed. Yeah. So
you see the depravity of people.
Absolutely.
So do you, especially with the child pornography stuff you've seen, do you look at people and just go, do you size them up? Like, my husband's an ex-cop, and I always say he's like got a cop stare. He'll just look out and I'll go, you've got your cop stare on.
Yeah.
And he's just like sizing someone up. Do
you size everyone up. You can't help it, because as a cop, going out on the beat, out on the road, you have to be so hypervigilant because your life and the community's life depends on it. You're watching everything, like just to pull over a car. You've got to be thinking things like where you pull up, if I have to get away, can I use that as a cover? You have to do that to survive out there. And like when you go and speak to the driver, you're always looking, where are their hands? What could they use? The same going into a house. What could they use as a weapon? Where do I get out if I have to? Because it does happen.
And that's not a normal state to be all the time.
No. And I got to the point where I was so hypervigilant that, like at the, you know, worst, when I started to unravel, hypervigilance, it was to the extreme. And I'd go and drive past friends' places and that to make sure they were safe. And, you know, ridiculous. Like when I look back, it's almost embarrassing saying, because you sound like it's just that's the effect of what you do. You know? But I keep having to say, it is the best job in the world, but you've just got to look after yourself. And these are all things that you can learn to deal with education.
Well, I wonder if back in the day, from that very first job, you know, from that very first suicide that you went to, to our poor Julie in the gutter, if there had been a process back then of helping you.
Yes.
You know, if you'd ever have reached the point of PTSD that you reached.
Well, funny you say that. I've often thought, I wonder if it was just always going to happen, like just when, I don't know. And I think that maybe I may have been able to control it, control those emotions and understand. Actually being diagnosed was the best thing that happened to me, because it all made sense. Mm-hmm. I started to think, that's why I feel like my heart had palpitations. I had I'm going to be very personal here, but I had terrible diarrhea. At the end, I had diarrhea for everything. And I'm thinking, what is going on? Why am I like this? Every time I saw a blue tarp or a blue bag, which I'll tell you about another time, but all these triggers, dogs, little baby dolls, you know, I'd think about these terrible SIDS or SUDIs that they call them now. It brings back all this stuff and I was just out of control. I didn't know what was going on. Mm. So the fact that I was diagnosed, it made sense and we could start to manage and work with my
symptoms.
And it wasn't just your mind, it filters through the body, obviously, with what's typical of PTSD with physical stuff.
Yes. So I had the flashbacks. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I had what's called sleep paralysis. The nightmares were really around me not being able to run, like I'd have to go and save you or something in my dream, but I couldn't run. Something would happen and my legs would be paralysed, or if I tried to shoot a gun, my finger would be paralysed. It's paralysis. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So there was that. There was really bad migraines. I got terrible, terrible migraines, which is, you know, pretty sort of standard. I was becoming really angry and like I'd bang the phone down at the – like, that's not me. But I was getting to the point where my head thought it was going to – I thought it was going to explode. I was that angry. I couldn't – uncontrollable. Wow. And I'd bang the phone down and I became short, like and rude almost. And I became a bit of a smartass in interviews. You know, I remember one pedophile I was interviewing and he made some excuse and I said – he said something like the, you know, little 8-year-old girl wanted it. And I said, of course she did. Like, that is so unprofessional. Like, even though you think that, to actually say it is so, like, it's unprofessional. You've got to remain professional in these things. I wanted them to talk to me and I wanted them, again, it was like, as horrific as it is, it's also, interesting is the wrong word, but what would ever make
why would you
someone want to abuse an innocent little child?
Yeah. And you'd want to get them, wouldn't you? You'd be like, I want to nail them.
Mm. Yeah, and to nail them, like you, that's exactly you're thinking, I want to nail you, you prick.
Yeah.
But to do that, you've got to, oh, really? Can you tell me about that? Yeah. How did that feel? So because you seem a bit interested, there's not many people a pedophile can talk to about a sex offence, about why they find this little kid so sexually attractive.
Yeah.
So to actually pretend that you are interested, they tell you. I couldn't get over the number of pedophiles that actually told me what they did. That's what you want, to be seen as fair, like to do it fairly, to do it by the book so that nobody could come back and say, you know, you abused his human rights or whatever. It was very satisfying to get somebody to talk to you with doing it all by the book, you know. So
I get that. I mean, it shows an incredible level of intelligence, strategic thinking, all of that. I can understand the thrill of sort of piecing that puzzle together.
Yeah. And to get rapport, like you think, how could you ever establish rapport with a pedophile? But it's like anything. If you cannot establish rapport with somebody, they're not going to want to talk to you, are they? If you, like, I told an example not all that long ago about a rapist, a really bad house entry rapist. He raped about, it was in Box Hill, and he raped, let's say it was 5 house entry rapes, but he was also stalking, like a real bad guy. Anyway, when we actually arrested him and we did a warrant on his house, him and I sat at the table, at the kitchen table, and he lived with his grandma. And something came up about, well, he was living with his grandma, and I said to him, you know, my grandma made the best bread and butter custard I have ever had in my life. And you know what? That's all it took. Because he said to me, oh, my grandma makes it with, and he said something about fruit loaf, right? And I said, oh, I've never heard. So the bottom line is something as simple as bread and butter custard, that was what we needed to sort of connect.
Yeah. Mm.
And that's when he put his head in his hands and he said, I'm sorry, Narelle, I've done it. I need to tell you. And it was like, wow. And he told me he did a reenactment. Oh, it was scary stuff.
Wow.
But my point being, it was that rapport. Like, to get a rapport with a rapist, people think, how could you do that?
Yeah.
But it's to get, like, in the end, it saved everybody going to court because he, you know, made full confessions, told us everything. So
wow.
There was no need for the victims.
And you saved other women.
Absolutely.
From potential.
So there's, it's not just, it's about getting them to talk to you. And it's not just for you, it's for all the other people that you save the trauma.
Mm. But your incredible brain also played tricks on you.
Mm.
I'm talking about the triggers now. Would
Big
you mind?
Time.
Would you mind telling us about the tarps?
The tarp was
blue tarps were a trigger for you, weren't they?
Yes, and blue
tarpaulins.
Yeah, and blue sports bags.
Mm.
Every body that I have, every deceased body that I have nearly ever found, has always been wrapped in a tarp. I don't know what it is, but they're wrapped in tarps. But the blue is about when I was working on the Mornington Monster job, which is John Sharp. He murdered his wife, Anna, and his little daughter, Gracie. And what he did was, after he'd murdered them, he put them into a blue sports bag separately. He murdered Anna, say, the Monday, and Gracie the Thursday. And what he did was he put them in a blue sports bag and threw them out in the household rubbish. Just that in itself, you can't get your head around that, can you? But he throws them out in the household rubbish. In the end, we found out through a process that the bags were at the Mornington transfer station. And so we did, I think it was about 20 days, we searched a rat-infested, filthy, asbestos-ridden tip. And we had to be in all this gear because of the asbestos. And anyway, I found Anna's bag, and it was there were that many blue sports bags in at the tip. Like, I don't know what it is, but there was a million. It's like when you buy a car and you've never seen that car before,
yeah.
And all of a sudden, you know, there's a million cars of the same. Well, this was about the blue bags. I've never seen so many blue bags in my life, and every blue bag we checked. Well, on the 19th of the 20 days, I checked a blue bag and Anna was in it. And she'd been speared, cut up with a chainsaw and put in this bag. So she was dismembered. And I found the bag. So, and it was a blue bag. So hence, you know, you don't need to be Einstein. That's why the blue sports bags.
Mm-hmm.
But then the body bag is blue. And there's a photo of me in the Age, on the front page of the Age when we found it. And I'm holding up a blue body bag to put Anna into. And so every time I see a blue tarp now, it just takes me back to all the bodies that I've seen, but more so that job. I will never, it's like anything that we, anything traumatic any of us go through, you will never be able to forget it, but you can deal with it. And so with the work I've done with the beautiful psychologist Ingrid, now I understand what's going on when I see a blue bag, and I've learned methods to manage it. It's like, you know, somebody that you love dying or getting sick or something. You never forget that, but you learn to live with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Narelle Fraser will be back in future episodes of Australian True Crime to talk us through some of the biggest cases of her career in detail. If you'd like to book Narelle for a speaking engagement, you can do so through her website, narellefraser.com. We have a link on our Australian True Crime Facebook page, where you can also buy copies of Emily Webb's books just by hitting the Shop Now button.
Thank you for downloading our Australian True Crime podcast. If you have an Australian true crime story of your own you'd like to share with us, let us know on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. We'd also love it if you'd give us a nice review on iTunes and 5 stars. Thank you to Sherry Laurie, Michael Davarin, Kieran Simpson and Alex Loran for their help in pulling this project together. We'll be back with more Australian True Crime next week. Until then, stay safe.